Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to present I'm going to present to you a supplemental chapter to a remarkable book that was published in 1995 and that I've discussed a number of times before on these airwaves. That book was authored by researcher Ed Haslam, last name H-A-S-L-A-M, and the book is entitled Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, subtitled The Story of an Underground Medical Laboratory, published in 1995 by the Wordsworth Press. It's a soft cover edition. This book developed some remarkable connections between the milieu surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy, specifically people who figured in Jim Garrison's New Orleans element of the investigation into Kennedy's assassination, and an underground laboratory in which experiments were being performed in which monkey viruses were injected into white mice in an attempt to produce cancer. These monkey viruses, specifically the SV40, were cancer-causing monkey viruses, and the book, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, develops connections between David Ferry, the U.S. intelligence operative and right-wing fanatic who was the central focus of Jim Garrison's investigation into the Kennedy assassination, and a woman named Mary Sherman, specifically Dr. Mary Sherman, one of the foremost names in American medicine in the second half of this century, a premier cancer researcher, and an individual who was a protege of Dr. Alton Oxner. Dr. Alton Oxner, also a very prominent name, not only in the civic affairs of New Orleans, but also in American medical and political life, was, like David Ferry, a right-wing fanatic whose name crops up in connection with the investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. Specifically, Alton Oxner was the head of an organization called INCA, the Information Council for the Americas, a right-wing propaganda outfit, an apparent intelligence front, that was the organ through which Lee Harvey Oswald was recorded pronouncing his pro-Marxist, pro-Soviet, and pro-Castro sympathies. It appears that Oswald was, in all probability, some sort of U.S. intelligence operative or paid informant. However, his proclamation of his Marxist sympathies, which was recorded under the auspices of INCA, was broadcast all over the United States in the wake of President Kennedy's assassination, giving the impression to many that the communists had killed Kennedy, and in the opinion of many researchers, leading to a cover-up of Kennedy's assassination by many who knew what had actually happened because they were afraid that if the truth emerged or the perceived truth emerged that the communists had been behind it, this would have led to a third world war. Many believe this was the precise aim, that is the cover-up of Kennedy's impending assassination, was the precise aim of the activities of INCA and also the people who circulated around 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place, the Guy Bannister Detective Agency, another right-wing outfit with strong intelligence connections, that at one point housed the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban organization, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, and which also was the address on which Lee Harvey Oswald's pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuba literature was stamped, Oswald being the only member of the New Orleans chapter of that organization. Ed Haslam has developed some compelling information that the real focus of the research being conducted under the auspices of this clandestine laboratory was an attempt to mutate the SV40 monkey virus in such a way as to permit a vaccine against cancer to be developed from that mutated virus. This experimentation appears to have been precipitated by the contamination of the polio vaccine with the SV40 virus. I realize this is a complex thesis, and I presented it at considerable length in not only a 3-hour interview that I did with Ed Haslam in the spring of 1996, but also 2 1-hour supplemental interviews that I've done with Ed Haslam. I've also interviewed Ed Haslam in combination with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of Emerging Viruses, Alan Cantwell, the author of, among other titles, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, and Dr. Garth Nicholson, who has done some remarkable research on an apparently genetically engineered microorganism, which appears to figure in many of the cases of Persian Gulf War Syndrome. All of those tapes are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire, and the address for Spitfire is P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. There's also an email address, ALCALAME, that's ALCALAME, at ix.netcom.com. And I'll give that address later on during the course of the presentation. Ed Haslam has carried on his research since his book Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus was published in 1995, and he has now written a supplemental chapter. And it is Ed's opinion that Mary Sherman was working with a linear particle accelerator that was being used to mutate the SV40 virus. Eventually, Ed's research led him to locate that linear particle accelerator. What I'm going to do now in the remainder of this half-hour segment and in the next half-hour segment is to read this supplemental chapter, this epilogue to the first edition of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. This is copyright 1997 and, again, is authored by Ed Haslam, last name H-A-S-L-A-M. The book can be ordered by dialing 1-800-MONKEY-X. Once again, 1-800-MONKEY-X. Dial that 800 number and you can order the book. Ed Haslam's epilogue begins, "By the summer of 1995, I had spent 3 years investigating the death of Mary Sherman, the history of monkey virus research, and the uncharted epidemic of soft tissue cancers." By the way, that soft tissue cancer epidemic appears to have been caused by the contamination of the polio vaccine with the SV40. Continuing, "I was exhausted. It was a watershed point for me. Much had been done, yet much was undone. I had to make a decision about publishing. Should I publish what I had found to date, even if it was incomplete, or should I continue researching, hoping to find more information? On the one hand, one of my major goals had been accomplished. Much of the nonsense surrounding Mary Sherman's death had been exposed. On the other, my list of unanswered questions stretched to the horizon. It was as if all my years of work were little more than clearing the brush before the real work could begin. The ultimate problem was that I had no way of knowing if additional effort would produce additional answers, or whether a major discovery lay just around the corner. For better or worse, I decided to publish the first edition just to get the story out, even if there was more work to be done. Perhaps it would trigger an investigation. Perhaps someone would come forward with more information. Perhaps our Orwellian monster would stir on its own. Anyway, I needed a break and felt I had done as much as I could for the moment. Ironically, it wasn't until I stopped writing and started publishing that I began to think about the set of unanswered questions from a broader perspective. My initial goal had been very general, to gather all the information into one place and look for an obvious pattern. What I found was a series of events that were both individually and collectively suspicious, but the overall pattern had not yet produced a coherent explanation. For example, could coincidence adequately explain how the soon-to-be-accused assassin of the President of the United States crossed paths with the former President of the American Cancer Society, who was working on an assignment for U.S. government which was so, quote, sensitive that it required clearance from the director of the FBI? Parenthetically, I would add, that former President of the American Cancer Society is the aforementioned Alton Oxner. Continuing, could social acquaintances explain why the chairman of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery had been associated with a contraband pilot who flew covert operations for the CIA? Parenthetically, those two individuals are respectively Dr. Mary Sherman and David Ferry. Continuing, could corruption adequately explain the extreme manner in which the New Orleans Police Department shut down the investigation into Mary Sherman's murder and sanitized their reports? All three seemed highly unlikely to me. I began to suspect that the individual pieces had been distorted to confuse the larger pattern. For example, if one saw Sherman's murder as sexual, it would be hard to see her death as part of events which were medical or as part of a larger pattern that was political. But once you knew that Sherman's death was not sexual, it changed both the appearance of that individual event and the appearance of the overall pattern." By the way, the cover version of Dr. Mary Sherman's death is that it was a lesbian psychosexual slasher killing. It was nothing of the kind. That's pure drivel. Continuing, "And what to make of Oswald Bannister and Ferry? Were they colorful, albeit irrelevant, ornaments that decorated the streets of New Orleans? Or were they somehow woven into the fabric of events that ultimately produced Mary Sherman's death? Actually, the pattern of distortions begged the opposing question. What were they trying to hide? Why did someone want us to think that Sherman's death was sexual? Why did they want us to think that Oswald was a communist? Why did they want us to think that viruses could not cause cancer? The simple question was enough to boggle the mind. Was there a larger pattern to the events around Dr. Mary Sherman's death? I began to see our scattered fragments like the tiles of a mosaic that would only reveal their larger pattern when arranged in exactly the right order. Perhaps there was a pivot question, unquote, a central piece of information around which all other answers would orbit. A single question whose answer would define the pattern. The more I thought about it, the more one question came into focus. Eventually, it glared at me like a full moon on a cloudless night. If Mary Sherman was electrocuted by a linear particle accelerator, then the critical question was, where was the linear particle accelerator located? Upon whose property did Mary Sherman die? Whose reputation was her masquerade murder intended to protect? Upon whose authority was the investigation into her murder shut down? I thought about the question every time I looked at the book. I wondered if I would ever find the answer. Linear particle accelerators themselves were not secret. The cover article in the July 27, 1959 issue of Time magazine bragged about the one at MD Anderson Hospital in Texas. However, linear particle accelerators were highly regulated. Under normal circumstances, the sale of a single accelerator would have generated a paper trail a mile long, particularly in the files of the Atomic Energy Commission. But was this a normal circumstance? My instinct said no. Times being what they were, I was not about to FOIA, that's Freedom of Information Act, the records of the Atomic Energy Commission by myself. Their ability to sandbag, avoid, and delay was far beyond my ability to persist. So I decided to stick to my strategy of patience and to wait for something to happen. 6 months passed with little change. Then the phone rang. It was a cold winter night in January of 1996. The voice was warm and familiar. It was a doctor who had quietly fed me information over the past several years. His kiss and tell stories about radioactive medicine and medical politics encouraged me at a time when little else did. I will call him Dr. X for reasons that will become obvious shortly. He was a medical doctor. We had spoken often, but not in recent months. During those earlier phone calls, he frequently talked about his long career and detailed many of the people and places he knew along the way. Of particular interest to me was his experience with linear particle accelerators. As a young surgeon in the early 1960s, Dr. X worked at a well-known cancer clinic on the East Coast. Operating on cancer patients was his business. Day after day, he removed tumors and repaired organs with varying degrees of success. The daily grind was an excruciating battle between life and death. As times changed, new technology brought new hope. Chemotherapy and radiation therapy offered alternatives to radical surgery and brought new promises to both doctors and cancer patients. Radioactive substances like cobalt-60 were injected into patients in hopes of destroying their tumors. It was a desperate hope. The side effects were often terrible. None of the medical staff liked the idea of injecting patients with radioactive substances strong enough to destroy living tissue, nor did they like the idea of standing by watching countless patients die. They all hoped that things would get better. Considering these circumstances, it was not surprising that Dr. X and his colleagues welcomed the introduction of the linear particle accelerator as a new, improved means of destroying cancer tumors. The accelerator's main advantage was that the direction of the radioactive beam could be controlled. Therefore, the intense radioactive beam could be aimed precisely at the tumor rather than emitting radiation in all directions and into the surrounding tissue as cobalt had done. Fewer healthy cells would be destroyed, and less radiation would leak into the bloodstream. It was an improvement, at least, and it offered new hope. The hospital spent millions of dollars on this new technology and renovated a building to house the huge machine which Dr. X came to use on a regular basis. In this setting, Dr. X came to know the people who designed and built his linear particle accelerator. One was Mr. Y, the company's director of sales, who had sold them the machine and who serviced their account. Mr. Y spent so much time at their hospital that he rented an apartment nearby. Dr. X and Mr. Y became friends as well as professional colleagues. At one point, Dr. X sublet a room in Mr. Y's apartment, so for a time they were roommates. Mr. Y was a colorful character, a Peter Paul and Mary vintage nonconformist with a Ph.D. in physics from Harvard. During the time Dr. X knew him, Mr. Y dated a beautiful French woman who danced with the Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall. According to Dr. X, Mr. Y's success was based both upon his brilliant mind and his father's close association with Harvard University's board of directors. Dr. X gave me all the relevant details, which are now in my safety deposit box and several other places. This night, Dr. X's voice was more excited than usual. He began by telling me about his recent trip to Europe, and then he updated me on a research project that he had been working on. Finally, he turned the conversation back to Mr. Y. By this time, Mr. Y and his linear particle accelerator were a familiar subject to me. He had built about 10 accelerators around the world. Each one was uniquely designed for a special application. From Israel to South Africa to New Orleans, Mr. Y shepherded the design, sales, and installation of some of the world's most mysterious machines. Dr. X reminded me on several occasions that Mr. Y had known Dr. Ochsner. This was dangerous ground for me, and I had no intention of being manipulated into any accusations about Dr. Ochsner or Ochsner Clinic. In fact, in 1968, my physics teacher at Jesuit had told our class about that the linear particle accelerator, In fact, in 1968, my physics teacher at Jesuit had told our class that the linear particle accelerator in New Orleans was not at Ochsner Clinic. So I tweeted these comments with caution. Meanwhile, I listened carefully for details which I might be able to confirm from another source. The problem was that there weren't many. Dr. X, however, kept encouraging me to look for evidence myself, evidence like a paper trail on the accelerator. At first, he talked about licenses and permits. Since I considered this to be a covert operation, looking for an overt paper trail sounded like a giant waste of time. Then Dr. X reminded me that it would be difficult to hide a huge machine which required a three-story building and 5 million watts of electricity. Perhaps there were records left in the files of the electric company. While this may have seemed like a reasonable route for a team of professional investigators, for an independent researcher like myself, it sounded like a wild goose chase down an obscured paper trail. And no one would leave an accelerator lying around. But he persisted. There must have been some kind of evidence left, even if the accelerator itself had been removed. Perhaps there was physical evidence like special wiring needed for the massive amounts of electricity. Note that detail, because that's going to come into play later. I told him I needed more information about the site itself. Perhaps then I could figure out where the machine had been located. The problem was that Dr. X had not talked to Mr. Y in years. The last he heard, Mr. Y had burned out on the stress and secrecy of exporting nuclear machinery and had gotten out of the business altogether. Dr. X wasn't even sure if he could find Mr. Y anymore. All of that changed with this phone call. Dr. X said he stopped on the East Coast to attend a medical meeting on his return from Europe. On the spur of the moment, he decided to try and locate Mr. Y. After several phone calls from his hotel room, he located his old roommate and invited him out for a drink. They met at a local restaurant and reminisced about old times. Eventually, Dr. X got his friend to talk about the accelerators he had built. Finally, Mr. Y talked about New Orleans. Here is a summary of what he told Dr. X about the linear particle accelerator project he supervised in New Orleans. And note carefully each of the following points. Continuing with Haslam's text, the project was extremely secret. Mr. Y had to sign a secrecy contract with the government before taking on the project and said that he could not disclose the exact location of the accelerator. 2. The design of the accelerator was unusual. Normally, an accelerator intended for medical use had clinical access features like ramps for wheelchairs or beds for patients to lie down on. Here, there were none. In fact, the objective was some form of laboratory experiment which required that the radioactive beam be split into equal portions for identical doses of radiation. 3. The overall design resembled an octopus. The accelerator's particle gun was located on the top floor of the building. The beam pointed down toward the ground and struck a pyramid-shaped metal structure on the bottom floor. The pyramid divided the main beam into several smaller beams of equal intensity and deflected them into a series of containment chambers which encircled the pyramid. The targets were placed on the containment chambers which were specially designed to hold heat and radiation. The metal pyramid was made out of platinum. The financing was unusual. Since linear particle accelerators cost millions of dollars, the machines were usually purchased on long-term contracts which were paid off over many years. But this case was different. The entire amount, approximately $10 million, and by the way, I would add that is in the early 1960s, that's a hell of a lot more money today, beginning again. The entire amount, approximately $10 million, was paid in advance. The next point, the method of payment was unusual. Mr. Y received 5 or 6 checks totaling approximately $10 million within 1 week. Each check came from a different company and was drawn from a different bank. And then Ed adds in parenthesis, so much for the paper trail. Mr. Y went to New Orleans frequently during the construction of the machine, but once it was completed, he did not go back to the site for a long time. Suddenly, there was a problem. He was sent to New Orleans to survey the situation. When he got there, something was obviously wrong. The accelerator building was guarded by soldiers with machine guns. Inside the building, there were thousands of mice in cages. They were doing some kind of vaccine experiments. Dr. Ochsner was in charge. Mr. Y described him as tense and extremely suspicious. And the final point, Mr. Y was particularly annoyed to discover upon his return home that military intelligence had been investigating his girlfriend while he was away tending to the accelerator. And then Ed Haslam goes on to comment, what a bombshell. This was the worst-case scenario. At first, I hardly knew how to react. Needless to say, I had serious questions about the reliability of the information. Was this information or misinformation? Was I being handed the most important information of my investigation, or was I being set up? Had I been given easily verifiable information for over a year, only to be handed a red herring at the last minute? Or was I being lied to by someone with a hidden agenda? It was a very perplexing situation. I had to be very careful. On the one hand, I did not even want to consider the possible implications of what could be phony information, because it might taint my view of the real information that I fought so hard to get. On the other hand, I had seen and heard a lot of strange stuff over the past 3 years, and much of it pointed in this direction. It was not unusual for unsupported information to lead to supported information, so I did not reject what Dr. X said either. But the bottom line was that I could not use it if I could not confirm it, so I decided to gatekeep the information and not let it inside, unquote, until I could verify it. I needed an action plan to sort all this out. I created my first, quote, information test, unquote. I decided to get Dr. X to repeat what he told me a second time. If he wouldn't repeat it, there was no point in my worrying about it. I called Dr. X back the next day and asked him to repeat everything he had said to me the previous night. He agreed. I was listening for inconsistencies. There weren't any. I recorded the phone call and made detailed notes. Before this second phone call, I wasn't really sure if I had information or misinformation. Now, I was sure that I either had information or misinformation. The difference was subtle, but important. I figured the odds were 2 in 3 that I was being manipulated for some reason, and my stress level doubled. Suddenly, I was back on the trail. The stakes were higher than ever. My next move had to be a good one. During my research, I had come to rely on a cadre of friends and researchers who sent me information. If I was being set up, I would be expected to rely on these same resources, any one of which might be working with Dr. X. I needed to use a clean source, someone that nobody could anticipate. Not only did I need to figure out how to confirm the information, I would also need to figure out who to trust with the assignment. The key question was still, where was the accelerator? I needed to locate it. I started to make a list of every medical-related facility in the New Orleans area. If Mr. Y's information was accurate, it meant the cover was so deep that every facility in the area, even the unlikely hotel locations like Hotel Dieu and the Children's Hospital, should be included on the potential location list. I tried to remember as much as I could about each facility, what I had heard and seen, what they looked like, and where they were located. As I compared my location list with Mr. Y's story, the problem became obvious. It was the machine guns. There were very few places where soldiers with machine guns could wander about without making the patients extremely nervous. To do so would attract attention and would violate secrecy. I quickly eliminated high-traffic facilities like Charity Hospital and Ochsner Clinic from my list. Other facilities like the Children's Hospital were better candidates because they were low-traffic facilities with sprawling campuses. I focused for a moment on the Children's Hospital. The very fact that most people would consider it an unlikely location made it an interesting possibility. The Children's Hospital was located in the university section between Magazine Street and the Mississippi River near Audubon Park. I had driven by it frequently during my years at Tulane. Its shady campus was covered with old oak trees whose heavy limbs hung near the ground. I had only been inside the hospital once. My mother and I had gone there to attend a memorial service for my father, who died the previous summer. He had been the president of the small hospital, and they were dedicating a therapy room in his honor. A nurse gave us a tour. It was a gallery of courage. I remember the children. They were stubbornly happy, despite the fact that they could have had plenty of excuses to be sad. Let me begin again. They were stubbornly happy, despite the fact that they could have had plenty of excuses to be sad. When the nurse explained that the hospital's name was being changed from Crippled Children's Hospital to Children's Hospital, a bedridden child said, "Yeah, we're children, not just crippled children," unquote. And in our next section, we're going to continue with Ed Haslam's fascinating expose about how he came across the site of the linear particle accelerator that he had correctly induced that Dr. Mary Sherman had been working on in order to attempt to mutate the SV40 virus, and in all probability that in turn was an attempt to create a vaccine to prevent a soft tissue to prevent a cancer epidemic stemming from the contamination of the polio virus. That cancer epidemic appears to be currently underway. I alluded to a tape duplication service called Spitfire in the beginning of the broadcast. I'm going to give the address, etc., for that once again, only a little more slowly. Spitfire is a tape duplication service that stocks all of the various tapes that I've done, not only the half-hour segments that I've recorded, but the various interviews that I've done, including three previous interviews with Ed Haslam alone, one of which is 3 hours in length and provides a very good summary of his remarkable book. In addition to the half-hour segments and the various interviews that I've done, Spitfire also stocks the weekly One Step Beyond shows that I do on my home base station, KFJC-FM. They also stock the archive shows, so please note that. Spitfire stocks the archive shows that I've done, as well as most of the lecture tapes as well. By mail, Spitfire can be reached at P.O. Box 1179. That's Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N. Capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, that's P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's one word, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. Once again, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. You can check out a description of all of the various programs available from Spitfire, as well as a list of those programs. You can access that on the KFJC webpage. KFJC is my home base station in the South San Francisco Bay Area. You can locate the webpage by pointing your web browser at www.kfjc.org and looking in the public affairs section. Once again, www.kfjc.org, and when you look for underlined sections, you will see an underlining for not only the archive shows, but also the various half-hour segments and descriptions of the interviews that I've done as well. I get a small royalty, from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies, from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. Other means of publication that I've started, and which is probably almost certainly now going to be defunct after one issue due to a lack of financing, there might be a second issue. Other means is currently on the stands. I am foregoing any profits I would have made from this in order to help balance the books. You can check at local retail book outlets for Other Means, or you can contact Other Means by mail at P.O. Box 191710, Box 191710, that's in San Francisco, California, 94119-1710. Once again, P.O. Box 191710, San Francisco, California, 94119-1710. And again, I'm foregoing any profits that I might have made in order to balance the books. That concludes this half-hour segment. We're going to continue with our analysis of Ed Haslam's epilogue in the next half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.